So it wouldn't have been useful. Thomas's Angelus, for instance, would have been useful as a source of direct quotations for a sermon, right? Would it have been useful?
Well, it could have been. My point is, it could have been
It could have
useful,
been,
but not as the only place to look.
yeah. Was it any more useful or any more comprehensive as maybe a guide towards exegesis? Like, was it any more comprehensive that way than as a source of direct quotations,
I
or?
mean, you have the gloss. Every student would have been very familiar with the Glossa Ordinaria, with Peter Lombard's sentences. I mean, you've got so much more angelic material in those 10 distinctions in Lombard's sentences. And he quotes in extenso patristic authors. One thing that's interesting about Lombard's sentences versus the entries in the Manipulus Florum is there's a lot more kind of moral advice in the Manipulus Florum. You get a lot more of that kind of effective theology, whereas Lombard really doesn't have much of that. It's much more speculative. But at the same time, there are really kind of intellectual speculative passages in the Manipulus Florum. So it's not only this kind of effective, moral, kind of spiritual reading type stuff. And I don't think we can pigeonhole it in that way. But no, I think the Glossa Ordinaria would have been much better for the Bible. Or simply attending lectures. You would have to go to lectures on the Bible. You would have to go to lectures on the sentences. No, obviously that's its limitation. It can't fulfill that role of a primer in the Bible, of a survey of a more quote unquote systematic survey of theology. I don't think.
And similarly, or since there's a tangentially, is this anonymous academic sermon was very heavy on biblical quotations. Was that the norm for sermons at this time, or would non-academic sermons have quoted more heavily from, say, patristic sources or something, or?
Sermon studies are not my forte. I can say I like to pass this to Chris Nyman if possible. He can help answer this question. But I do the sermons I have looked at, yes, do make first the sermons start with a lemma from scripture. They start with a scriptural passage, and they very often build and weave in other scriptural passages. So scripture is certainly very important. I have not looked at enough to say that, 10% of the citations are to patristic sources and 90% to the Bible, but I think the Bible, it tends to be the primary authority. Do you have?
Good. Well, because it's something that, I mean, looking at French Protestant sermons, like someone who's done it quantitatively, 98% of
You know that.
quotations,
Sure.
in Huguenot sermons are biblical. So at least 2% that
Yeah,
aren't.
there
So
you go.
I'm wondering, and so I mean,
Yeah.
the Manipulus Florum in a Calvinist context, that's one of the things that I'm always wrestling with. So I'm wondering what, if there are vague numbers or specific numbers or ratios that exist for.
Well, I've studied academic sermons delivered in an academic setting, but I've looked at the conciliar sermons, and you're looking at, preaching to the converted, right? I mean, you're really, it's a common audience of well-educated people, and it's heavily Protestant. I would guess that the ad populum sermons would be much more scriptural because it'd be much more accessible to a lay audience. But I will defer to any of those. The author sermons.
I mean, the ones I've looked at, like by Leo the Great and other people like that, yeah, they're mostly biblical quotes. Sometimes they get off topic unless they focus on the biblical text, but they're, I don't remember being left with a lot of patristic references.
Well, they are the fathers, so I mean,
Well,
I'm not going to say
earlier church fathers.
From what I've looked at in terms of the sermons, it seems that yes, the Bible is the principal source, but it's one of those things you repeat it often enough and you forget what it means, right? And sometimes it's nice to have another way of saying the point that you're trying to make, and not just with a scripture tag, because it gets boring. So it seems to me that's where the manipulus can really be helpful. It says in another way what scripture says. So I mean, that's what every preacher has to do every week, or a day, or however often they're preaching. It's a way of helping to keep the point you're trying to make fresh, it seems to me.
But you still need the Bible.
You start with the Bible, but But after you've, you know, quoted John 3:16 100 times, well, okay, so now what? And you have to go beyond that, in a sense. And,
oh, no,
so,
and I think this would have certainly been, the Magnificent Psalm would have certainly been used as a preacher's aid.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm just questioning whether it's accurate to say it was primarily intended as a preacher's aid.
Yeah. Well, as I said earlier, I think the kind of intellectual and spiritual formation that for students, and if all masters are supposed to be students and all masters are preachers, well, anyhow, we're all kind of in the same.
Yeah.
That it is a that kind of spiritual exercise of reading this sort of material, especially if it's unencumbered with so much of the stuff that might otherwise be there, that it's nicely focused on this topic or that topic. It gives you, it gives you a place to hang your hat, when not only for yourself personally, but also when you're preaching. There's a big difference between preaching and teaching, and I've come to learn. And the principal difference is this. That when you're preaching, you got to mean what you're saying, okay? You can't pull punches. And when you're teaching, you can say this and say that, and well, so-and-so says this, and so says that, and yeah, whatever you want to believe is okay with me. But you can't do that when you're preaching. So you have to be able to focus and say in a way that is from your heart what the text means. So I think that's where, to me, that's where this comes in. It's a particularly useful aid to personal formation for preachers. and as we're saying, most of these people would wind up doing some preaching anyway. So it would make sense. I mean, that's you know, I know I'm reading back, so to speak, into the situation what I know is my own experience, but at the same time, I think it works.
Well, the prophecy says that you often hear these in two places, in lectures,
mm-hmm.
And I think the Rosses are correct in locating that in the university lecture hall,
mm-hmm.
And sermons.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, praedicatio is a big topic for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that this is going to take the place of a Ars Praedicandi,
no.
But it does talk about the approach to being a preacher, the
mm-hmm.
formation into the spiritual growth as part of preparing yourself
mm-hmm.
to prepare others for other things. Right?
Mm-hmm.
If I could just swing back to Peter and Giles, I've been tempted many times to go looking for hard to find quotations in these two sources, because I know now that that Thomas used two of the books that he left to the Sorbonne, the Secunda Secundae and Peter Bloss letters directly for compiling the Manipulus, or at least the portion that he did. Would these be rich places to look for those hard to find, hard to identify, or heavily paraphrased patristic quotations?
It was hard in the case of Angelus and Diabolus because these were, I guess, I don't know, I've been studying angels and demons for a bit, and it didn't seem that any of these jumped out at me as something hard to find or something you know, shockingly novel that doesn't get included often. And I was surprised to find that there were not many overlaps between the academic, you know, the strict, you know, academic sentences commentary and the Quo Libeto questions. There weren't that many overlaps in the passages cited. You know, you have 42 citations on angels and demons, but I said a lot more Aristotle, a lot more Dionysius. And again, it may show us, you know, the kind of what's going on in those really intense discussions in the university and then the patristic authorities that are behind that. And I've even looked through Lombard sentences. I only found 6 of the 42 that were attested in Lombard, which is a much richer kind of source as a collection of patristic sayings. And only 6 of 42. So in this case, no, but it's not, that's not to say that it's impossible in other cases. But they're very different works than the Nicholas form, obviously. Have you ever, I guess the Secunda Secunda is a good example of where he does use. I haven't looked into it personally, but it's hard to say. I mean, I guess it would take sustained research to say, okay, which are the ones I want to try and seek out, and then, I mean, Peter Tarantese's commentary is very difficult to search. You'd have to just, it's the old printed edition. Giles is a little better because you can have it on a PDF. You know, I have it on a PDF, and it's a little, but still none of them are data-based in the sense that we have modern editions like in the Corpus Christianorum where you can just, you know, punch in the words. So. I don't know.
You have to know where to look, right?
And you have to know where to look.
They're nicely organized, so you go, okay, here are the likely places to find.
And I was looking for that with Angels and Devils, and again, it's a tiny fragment of the Manipulus Forum, but didn't see an incredible overlap here, even in Lombard senses.
Is your sense that that these two topics represent his own reading? He's culling through his favorite sources and pulling things out? Or are there unknown intermediaries here?
So one thing I was trying to look at before I came to present was the Flores Paradisi and try and get a sense of, okay, but again, when I look at the Flores Paradisi, it's arranged by author. So he would have to go by author and say, okay, I like this one. And he only has two from Augustine in Angel, in Angelus, which, and there are 27 or so entries. And so it's strange that he would only, and Augustine has tons to say about the angels. Anyone who reads Lombard Sentences, those 10, I mean, Augustine dominates that discussion. And he only has two kind of, you know, they're interesting passages from Augustine, but the other one, the...
And Augustine's number one for Thomas, but yeah, not for these topics.
It's odd. To be honest, your question is excellent, and I simply confess a lack of time to actually try and seek through and ferret out. No, it's good. It's good. I could. I certainly will and can try and figure out where how he's constructing Angelus and Devilus. Mine was more kind of look at the finished products. Okay, how useful could this product as it existed have been, but you're right, it's a very good question. How did, you know, considering what we know about how it would have functioned with a university reader, how did then he, did he kind of create it in a way that would have been tailored to a university audience? It's a great question, and I'll certainly look at that as I spend more time with this.
And I think with that, the idea of what is formation, in your comment on that idea, I wondered if it was, you were interpreting it in more of a warm, fuzzy kind of formation way as opposed to intellectual formation, right? How you think, what you think, what you're reading about, because that is part of formation at this period, right? It's not just feeling good and going to counseling, like we might think of some formation pieces today. And I'm not being pejorative. I think these are important formation pieces, but intellectual formation mattered. So in a conversation about self-formation, that also matters, right? So don't just dismiss formation because it's not just about how you live in this way kind of way, but also how you think and what you think about to inform those thoughts.
Yeah, but I guess what struck me about Angelus and Diabolus, they're not arranged any, they're not, there's no systematization. He's got them arranged by authors, and it's to make some kind of sense of it, to get some kind of idea about the angels, you've kind of got to pick, and you have to have some kind of external aids. So it's not like, at least in these topics, it's not like you can come to these topics and say, okay, I want to learn something about the angels and demons. And it's not going to kind of walk you through that process. It's much more open, I think, and it's open to many different types of uses, but it's not, I can't imagine it really serving as a formation, like kind of giving you the primarily at least, is giving you, yeah, okay, we've got the lecture on the angels tomorrow and for the next week. Let me go check and let me bone up on these things in the Manipulus floor and I'll be ready. I can't imagine it being that helpful in that way. But it could be very helpful in providing you with some key authorities to use. It does touch on a lot of different topics. I mean, just look at some of the reading. I mean, there's so many different things. Damascene's definition of an angel is one that's used. That's in fact the one that comes up the most. Damascene's definition of the angel comes up in Giles, Cor de Bedel. It comes up in Peter of Tarentaise's census commentary. It even comes up in the sermon. Jerome's is probably the second. Every soul has a guardian. You know, great magna dignitas animarum.
Truly common places.
These were truly common places that you would see. But I mean, like the one about the demons know in the future. You know, it's not, you know, you read that one, is that spiritual reading? Is that, you know, a nice quote to talk about angelic knowledge, which is a big issue. But it doesn't give you any context for these things. It doesn't help you use the Aristotelian or the philosophical framework to approach them or to debate these issues. So again, I simply say it has limitations. It's kind of the point.
I think to that point, Christian know better, but looking through the whole manipulus, some of the Lamada, there's very few entries, right? They're very, very short. Aren't there some with like
two, three,
I mean, five, you can't do much.
You didn't like, your usury was not a big topic. Yeah. Which you might expect in a preacher.
The church had solved that by then.
So I mean, so some of the prior knowledges might be like to jog your memory or a source of inspiration to take you in another direction or something, as opposed to coming with a blank slate and expecting to have a...
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, Tosha's got a lot of good stuff. I mean, I like his prefatory remark that drawn from Seneca, you know, and again, we saw how kind of fatiguing it was to read through those 10 or 12. I mean, maybe it wasn't fatiguing for you. Maybe you really enjoyed it. I hope. And, you know, much better minds than me. But you know, these are complex, you know, you read, even in English translations, like, okay, focus. What's he talking about? And we've been here for a while. But, you know, it's hard to imagine students just saying, okay, I'm going to read my two or three pages from the Manipulus Florum. And I like the idea that, you know, you would excerpt something or try and you know, meditate on one thing perhaps. But again, I'm not sure that that's the only or the intended use. I think it could be one of many uses. That's what I'm trying to posit, at least, for thought.
A question you talked about, you quoted the beginning, and you talk about his quote that the purpose is for self-improvement. What's the Latin word that he uses there for self-improvement?
Homo se posit juvare, or posit se juvare homo in omni materia, posit homo se juvare, can help himself, or juvare, I think it's not the passive, but a man can help himself. Literally, in omni materia. It's a strange word. Materia normally means topic, but in this case, it doesn't seem to mean that. In every topic, maybe.
In every respect.
In every, I say in every, I think every way is good, but he used the word materia as an interesting one in the prologue, because he uses it specifically to mean the topic headings later. He uses it four or five times to say, in materia, blah, blah, blah. And he's saying in topic, with the topic headings, amicitia, diabolus, whatever, usuria. But in this case, I don't think it necessarily works. It's a word with a lot of valence. And that works the same way. It's such a problem.
I've noticed that before, but yeah. In all 256 yeah. topics, and there are no more.
Yeah, maybe.
Can you say, with this particular section on angels and devils, was there any kind of focus or particular emphasis that Thomas seems to come back to, as opposed to, you know, I mean, lots of things, but was there something that kept coming up?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. It's a good one. When I initially sat down to write this paper, and I came to this first section of describing the contents of Angelus and Diabolus, I was initially tempted to separate all the more effective, so to speak, A with an A, all the more kind of sayings with moral applications, or here's how to resist the devil, and here's how to cooperate with your guardian angel. There are a lot of those. There are a lot of that can at least apply to that. And I said, okay, this is how I'm going to divide. I'm going to show how it's primarily got an effective spin to it, or effective, you know, feel to it. And then I started to look, and then I said, okay, no, but let me step back. Let me read these. And, like, you know, you come across some of the more speculative or technical ones, and you realize how dense some of these sayings are. And I resisted the temptation to kind of, you know, say this is one category and this is the other. I think it's probably more accurate, and this is why I chose the approach I did, to say it's very broad. Yes, there's a lot of Bernard, which is wonderful stuff. But it's, again, it's giving you advice. You know, don't offend your guardian. I can't. You know, he says in every corner, show reverence to your angel. But the Latin's beautiful. It's, you know, in quo vis angulo, angelo tuo reverentiam habe.
Don't
which is beautiful. I mean, it's lovely. You can't translate it. But so you have a lot of that kind of more effective stuff, but there are too many kind of more speculative or more informational, you know, like Gregory's quotes on the name angel. I mean, it's for knowledge. It's not necessarily, you're not going to say, you know, my heart's, you know, afire because now that I know that angel means messenger, you know, I'm going, you know, listing the nine orders, it's essential knowledge, but it's not necessarily effective. So again, I resisted that temptation, and I hope that's the right choice, but we could test it in other topics. And again, Angelus and Diabolus is interesting and odd because it was such a big, because it had such a correlation to an academic topic. I think it was kind of helpful to maybe bring this perspective into our conversation about the Manipulus Forum because it gives us those insights.
Yeah, for the balance with the more effective topics.
But there's still a lot of effective stuff. There's still a lot of effective stuff.
And I think it's a good thing that you haven't done that separation, because in order to, you know, live your effective life properly, you know, you need that knowledge. So obviously, there's no wonder that they are put together, because you have to know what to do. So you have to know things and then know how to use it effectively. So there's the first part, which is more into, you know, proper knowledge, scientia, and then to wisdom, which is more linked to effectivity, which is scientia. So, but those two are complementary, so mm-hmm. you cannot separate them.
So they're a common, they're joined yeah,
exactly.
as a topic. Of the language.
Exactly, and yeah. that's why you cannot separate them. Yeah. So Thomas has to put some, you know, scientific, you know, basic information in it in order to make sense of what to do effectively after that.
Yeah. I just wanted to float this as well to the colloquium. I only use the word theology here, but there are a lot of ways in which someone studying canon law, I think, could find the Manipulus Forum interesting and helpful as well. I mean, look at this. There are a lot of, many. I didn't go through systematically and cross off all seven sacraments, but most of them are there. There are legal terms. So again, I wonder how Thomas himself owned some canon law manuscripts. So it's something to keep in mind too. How his interest in canon law may have shaped some of this as well. I guess this is another kind of point about it. I think it's broadness. And I think that the broadness is its strength, or the versatility is its strength. But just for further thought. I'd be interested to look at what he says about Philosophia. I should have read through the entries there and see what kind of, how he paints philosophy, especially since I talk about, you know, the need to bring philosophy to the Manipulus Forum in an academic context for it to really be effective. But
well,
at least for Angel
from
Davis.
From Gellius, so yeah. It was, I think, sort of typical of the overall construction of philosophy. I haven't really gone through it systematically and thought about it, but I think you're right. That would be a good touchstone for broader discussion. Do we have any questions here?
Mark Selt has a question. He says, "Nice to see you, Lewis. I was interrupted in the middle of your talk and came back. Would you say that the material on angels is conservative, reflecting the material that Cistercians gathered in the collections from which Hibernicus borrowed, rather than presenting the latest word on our winged friend?" And then in parentheses, "By the way, this is celestial screensavers behind your head are a nice touch for you."
Thanks. Well, the clock and the calendar do kind of take away from the eternal idea.
Good to see you again, I suppose, Mark. Thank you for the question. Certainly it is conservative. Sure, it's conservative. I mean, it doesn't really. I guess my point is, it doesn't really get. It can't really get you into the school discussions about angels. It's even conservative compared to Lombard. If you took Peter Lombard's and without a commentary, and you looked at the 10 distinctions there, that's much more cutting edge than what you find in the Manipulus Forum. That's 150 years earlier. So I think it may be the nature of the work, but it's interesting that if we can find ways, as Chris has pushed me, to identify how specifically, precisely, Thomas constructed these sections, I think I can speak much more persuasively about the conservative nature of the entries. But conservative. I would say yes. If conservative means that he's not really directly kind of engaging in the big debates of the 13th century, then yes, they're conservative. But a lot of these same texts are also helpful in the cutting edge discussion. So they're at the base of like Damascene's definition or some of Augustine's sayings or things about demonic knowledge. You know, you have that interesting one about them knowing the future. These would have been still pertinent in the cutting edge talk. So it's hard to say without any kind of apparatus or any kind of commentary. It's still a little baffling to me what the precise purpose of it all was, if there was one precise purpose. So yes, I would say it's conservative in that sense.
So what you're saying is that Thomas doesn't tell us how many angels can dance on the head of a pin.
He does not. No. Only Rabelais asked that question. It's much later. did I answer your? I mean, please push me, Mark, if I've skirted the question unsuccessfully.
Thank you.
We could talk more about it if you want.
Well, perhaps that is it. I mean, perhaps he's, because it is such a spotty and uneven approach to the topic, he's skirting the hot button ones and focusing on the ones that are safe for students.
Yeah.
In their formative moment, I want to push them. They're not ready for the meat yet, right? It's milk time.
Exactly. That's what you were saying. It is just the basic of the discussion, and then they can use it further in their study at some point, maybe.
I mean, let me give you an example of how it could be. It could enter into the really kind of cutting-edge debates about, you know, you saw twice that the question is asked whether form and matter, whether the angels are made up of form and matter. And this is one that's discussed kind of perennially in the second half of the 13th century, into the 14th. And there are they're actually in the 1277 condemnations, there are certain angelic teachings that are condemned among those, philosophical teachings. But with the form and matter one, so there's nothing really in the manipulous form that helps you get into that. The only place I could point is Damascene's definition, who says they're incorporeal. So if you want to pick up on that and kind of say, well, what does he mean by incorporeal? Okay, maybe you're heading in the right direction to getting into this debate, but that's about as close as you get to one of the big topics. But there's some little glimmer there of that being an issue. And if you looked at Damascene's larger kind of little chapter in his on the Orthodox faith, you know, he gives you some more information. So if you actually trace that down, you could start entering more into that discussion. It's really hard to say.